This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. When Daoud Haroun took a sacred pilgrimage to Mecca in 1967, he met people from all around the world. One day he's walking alone through the desert and was enveloped by a crowd of people who thought they knew him. They had been traveling from West Africa and were certain that he was from their village. In fact, he was from Boston, and he had never been to that village. And while this would be a disorienting experience for many of us, for Daoud Haroun, it has become the norm. Wherever he goes, he meets people who feel like they have always known him. And that may be because he is a man who defies categorization. He's been a shoeshine boy, a trombonist, an ethnomusicologist, a teacher, and a student of world religions. He has lived many lives in his 81 years and was most recently awarded the United States Artist Fellowship that recognizes him as one of America's most accomplished and innovative artists. He's been living in Durham for almost a decade and joins me in the studio today, Daoud Haroun. What a pleasure to have you on the program. Welcome.
Wow, is that me you're talking about?
That's only part of you. That is really not you.
Hey, man.
And you are one of the few people in the world who could actually take us back to the date of your birth and
yes.
tell us a story about that.
Wow. May 13th, 1934. Mother's Day, to be exact. Mother's Day, 1934. I think the same day that the Dion Quintuplets. I don't know if anybody out there is old enough to remember the Dion Quintuplets, but we were born on that day.
And you would have won a prize. Your mother was eligible for a prize.
Yeah, I think in Boston in 1934, which was the height of the Depression, one of the milk companies, I don't know if it was Pet Milk or one of them, had offered a prize for the first baby born on Mother's Day. So from what my mother said, with all these ladies in the delivery room grunting and groaning and carrying on trying to win this prize, you know, because I think the prize was like milk for the rest of your life and, you know, food and a little bit of money. And anyway, she grunted, and I came in last. And that's sort of like the story of my life.
A late bloomer.
I'm a late bloomer.
On the first day of your life.
On the first day of my life.
Yeah. Well, I know that story is one that will recur throughout our conversation here.
Sure.
Tell us more about your family. Now, they were part of the Great Migration.
Yes, they were part of the Great Migration from South Carolina back in the in the 1920s, actually, and my mom was from Colombia, and according to the records, they were slaves. Her parents were slaves in South Carolina for going back almost 300 years. My father, who lived in Colombia, who was a tailor by trade, his folks were from the Charleston area, Edisto Island, Johns Island, in that area, they call them saltwater Geechies. Now, since anthropology has stepped into it, they now call them the Gullah people. And so what I heard in my mother's kitchen, you know, which we called Geechee, now they call it Gullah. So
interesting place to grow up, though, with that family background and bringing all of that historic southernness to your home in Boston. And Boston's an interesting place. It is a vibrant jazz community. There's a lot of educational opportunities. I mean, I think just the difference between what you were doing with your spare time and how your sister was educated would shine a light.
Oh, wow. Two different worlds.
On the opportunities, yeah.
Boston is also a cold place.
Yeah.
It's like London. It's foggy and rainy and cool, you know. Yeah, but you're talking about my sister.
Yeah.
You mean the differences?
Yeah, the differences.
Yeah.
Kind of what was interesting to you as a young man?
When my sisters were born, my dad was still around, okay? My family was still intact. So they had the benefit of having a dad and that kind of supervised household. I don't think my mother was working then, but and she was part of a period in Boston when they had the Boston Latin School, girls high school, what they call them Latin schools, where they learned the classics. They learned how to speak Latin and Greek, and they learned several languages. My sister was an amazing woman. Matter of fact, she gave birth to an amazing child, one of the great directors, film directors today, Ernest Dickerson, who's doing The Walking Dead, is her son. I mean, he did Juice and so forth. But anyway, as I was mentioning before, in my bedroom, I'd be listening to, You know, Louis Armstrong and Duke Ellington and Charlie Parker and Dizzy Gillespie and, you know, the vernaculars were quite different. She was speaking very prim and proper, and she was want to correct me quite a bit, you know, when I'd say, hey, where's Mama at? Jackie, where's Mama at? She said, behind the preposition, and she'd always be holding me on point. But I had that kind of sister, and there was that kind of diverse flavor in the house.
Yeah. And you were hanging out at jazz clubs at a pretty early age, too.
Yeah. During the Second World War, I was a shoeshine boy and a bootblack and a news hawker in Boston during the Second World War. When I was about 8, 9, I remember VE Day, the day that President Roosevelt died, I was downtown, you know, shining those shoes, you know.
Listening to people, paying attention to people, including jazz artists, you'd already had an interest in the music, and you were meeting some of the artists, right?
Sure. Most of the places back then during the war, most of the nightclubs, they weren't nightclubs, they were day clubs. And the music was playing from, say, about 11 o'clock in the morning to maybe 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning. So wherever you go, there was jazz playing, all kinds of jazz. You
know? Did you ever think it was for you? Like, you're a young man, you're growing up, you're shining shoes. And
it's always been for me.
Yeah.
Really. I mean, I found out today, it's part of that one we're talking about, the one. It's always been for me. From birth, it's been for me. I must say that it's been one long, sequential rendezvous romance, actually, with the diversity of the world. I mean, in all its diversity. You know, Boston was a big military town, so we had military from all over the world there, from Nepal, from Bhutan, from you name it, we had it.
You are today on The State of Things. We are talking to Daoud Haroun, my guest today on The State of Things, a jazz musician who has just won quite a prestigious award. We are talking about the journey to that award and well beyond that. This diversity, you're talking with jazz artists, you're talking with all the people who, as though that you have something to learn from them, and you can then, did you think you were going to be a jazz musician? When did that occur to you?
Well, I never thought of myself ever becoming. I always thought, that's an interesting question.
I hate that question, Frank.
It's like if you're swimming in the ocean, this is how I envisioned it. Yeah. If you're in the ocean swimming, and then somebody hollers to you from the pier, you know, are you swimming? Are you in the water? Or are you a swimmer or whatever? And you're in the ocean and you look up and you say, well, hey, man, I'm in it. You may be doing a backstroke. You might be doing the Australian crawl. You might be doing the doggy paddle or whatever, but you're in the ocean. So jazz or music or whatever type of music it is, it's like there's the people who are playing the music, then the people who are provoking the music, and then the people who are listening to the music. So it's very much, as you said earlier, it's about the one. It's all one. It's all interdependent. You know, you switch roles. One day you're in the audience and the next day you're on the stage.
Which started at a very early age for you. You were both a performer and a listener in jazz clubs when your mother was checking coats.
Right.
And you were, tell us that story.
Well, my mother was a hat check girl. I hope folks down in this part of the country know what that is. But in the north, they wear overcoats in the winter and fur coats and all. This is during the Depression. And of course, I was carried. I mean, I guess I was responding to this music when I was in her stomach, no doubt about that. But after I was born, she really couldn't afford a babysitter. So she used to bring me to this after-hours club and put me in a box on the floor under the coats and a pillow. She put a pillow in this box and lay me down, maybe put a... I don't remember kids having pacifiers back then, but I guess she stuck something, you know, an apple, an orange, piece of toast or whatever it was. And then when the jazz musicians came in, as she told me later, gentlemen, Duke Ellington, Louis Armstrong, Coleman Hawkins, you name it, and she'd kick the box and I'd start crying and they'd look over and see me down on the floor and they'd say, oh, poor little baby, and they start flipping silver dollars and stuff in the box. So I guess I was kind of consecrated or blessed.
An early jazz performer in the very earliest days. I want to talk more about this. In those jazz clubs, when did you start going as a listener? How young were you when you started to go and really enjoy the music?
I had cousins who were in the not only playing music, but they were bartenders and cooks and waiters in some of these clubs. And so as I was shining shoes downtown, I'd stop by every now and then, you know, and holler at my cousin, holler at one of my sister's boyfriends, and they'd say, why don't you just come on in, you know? And they let me come in the clubs, and I wrote a short story about this, by the way, called A View from Under the Table. And they let me sit under the tables. They had tablecloths on the tables then, and they had sawdust on the floor. So I'd get under the table. I'd get under the table near the stage so I could peek up, pull the curtain up, and look up, and there were all the greats on the stage, you know. All the old-timers from New Orleans were there. You know, Henry Red Allen was one of the greats that I actually met him years later. I met him in New York when I was playing and had the honor to spend some time with him in New York, and he helped me quite a bit. He helped me as a kid. It shows you how the linkage is. When I was a little kid, then years later, I was grown and in New York City, and I happened to meet Henry Red in a music store. I had my trombone stolen, and I was trying to find a way to get another horn. I had a gig.
All right, we're going to leave the story right there. And when we return, we'll hear the end of that and more of the development and the journey of Daoud Haroun on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with me. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio, talking this hour with Daoud Haroun. Born in Boston in the early 30s, spent his life exploring the intersection of music, history, religion, life itself. And we left you in New York City without a trombone.
That's right. And a friend of, well, not quite. A friend of mine had an old beat-up trombone that he thought I could use, and the slide didn't work too well. So I brought it to a music store on 52nd Street to see if it could be, if anything could be done with it. And, of course, they pronounced that it should be thrown in the garbage can. But who comes up the stairs in this music store? And for those of you who know New York, this was Giardinelli's, which was on the second floor on 52nd Street, right next to the Roseland Ballroom, which used to be have music almost 24 hours a day. And I introduced myself to Red, and he was quite peppy, and he said, hey, man, do I know you from somewhere? I said, no, but I know you. And then I pinpointed, I used to, you know, shine your shoes under the table at, you know, such and such a club in Boston. He said, oh, yeah, I remember you. You're the kid that used to shine my shoes. And, you know, hey, so he said, what can I do for you? And I said, hey, man, I need a horn. So he took me up. He hollered out the window downstairs. And he had a purple, like a lavender Cadillac convertible down in the street, double parked. The cops were watching the car for him. And so he hollered down to his ladies in the car, you know, hollered down to the cop, said, oh, I'll be right down. I got a friend. He took me over to Jack's Drum Shop in New York, walked in the store. Jack came over to him and said, hey, Red, what's happening? He said, hey, I got a friend here needs a favor. He says, what is it? Any friend of Henry Red is a friend of mine. I said, hey, man, I need a horn. You know, I got a gig tonight. I have my horn stolen. And next thing he says, hey, man, we just got a shipment right over there. Take your pick. And that's how the horn I have right now is that very same horn that I got from Jack's Drum Shop. And I said, well, I don't have any money. He said, don't worry. He says, you pay me back as you can. Like I said, any friend of Henry Red is a friend of mine. So you never know who you're going to meet when you're a kid.
You were playing the horn at the time, but you actually started out as a percussionist, right?
Yeah, I started out as actually a bongo player. And then I graduated and got a conga drum. And my cousin, Jimmy Stevens, was playing for and with, you know, a lot of the dancers in town. So I would go on the gigs with him and work with all the different, from everything from, you know, striptease artists to tap dancers to exotic dancers. And then, of course, we eventually got around to playing for the dance classes of a real Boston hero, and that's Alma Lewis. Those of you who know dance know that Alma Lewis is one of the great divas of of the Boston scene.
You were doing pretty well then, but somebody noticed that you were actually just trying to make melodies out of those drums and suggested you move to the horn.
Yeah, some of the really intuitive musicians that I was playing with at the time said, "Hey, man, you know, you're really stretching that drum to the nth degree. You know, you sound like you're trying to play bebop on the conga drum. Sounds like you're trying to play melodies and harmony. So why don't you think about getting a horn?" You know, and I said, "Hey, I never thought about it." And he said, "Well, what kind of horn should I get?" And he said, "Well, you know, Roland's got a tenor, and Ray Pitt's got a tenor, and Sonny got an alto, and this guy got a trumpet. So there's no trombone players around here. So why don't you get a trombone?" And that's what I did.
And the story of that first trombone is also fortuitous because you met a very important mentor.
I went down to Cape Cod and worked in the kitchen, washing dishes through the summer, came back, bought this beautiful horn, and came up to, you know, which was like the scene in Boston then, was the corner of Mass and Columbus Avenue. And the Musicians Union was there, and usually through the day people would be rehearsing, and I brought the instrument with me. And there was one band leader that was having a rehearsal, and in that band, in the trombone section, was just sitting there waiting for me. It was a man by the name of Charlie Connors, who later became Duke Ellington's bass trombone player and was with the Dizzy Gillespie band, Quincy Jones band. But anyway, when the guy said, "Hey, man, take the horn out. Let me take a look at it." You know, and I said, "Well, I don't know how to take it out of the case." So he said, "Come over here, man, and let me show you how to take it out of the case." I took it out of the case, and he said, "Watch it, man. Be careful. You have to treat this instrument just like you treat a Stradivarius." And I've always remembered those first lessons. He said, "Look, be very delicate. This is a very delicate instrument. And if you take care of it, it will take care of you." So he said, "Look, come on over here and sit beside me in the band. And this is your place right here beside me. And you just watch. You just sit here, listen, and watch. And whenever you get a chance to understand what's going on, take a chance and try. But, you know, don't play anything until you feel secure you can." And that's how I learned how to play the trombone.
There's a real pattern beginning to emerge here. You're getting your whole education on the street. You're going from one meeting, one fortuitous meeting to another.
Isn't
it
amazing? It's amazing.
What is it about that, though? Because we all meet people.
God,
we all meet people who could probably help us along the way.
It's all about the one, as you said, the one. And the one that Frank and I are referring to is actually the creator, the creative spirit, which I've called in some of my talks the eternal sacred, or the sacred eternal, or the wonder, the mystery, the great spirit, whatever you want to call it.
There is a oneness to which we all belong.
Right.
And we all make up a part of that. It's ineffable. It's not understandable. It is beyond comprehension. And yet we're individuals. You play the trombone. I don't. I talk on the radio, and I got a whole family full of people who don't do that either. And so knowing how we fit.
But it's all related. I mean, you're doing your thing the way you've been guided to do your thing. And it is very much related to music. It's very related to the spiritual. It's very related to a remembrance of the one, because see, you're a teacher, you're a reminder, you're by the looks of you, you look like you're on your way to being an elder. You know, soon to be an ancestor.
I'm feeling very ancestral at the moment. But let's talk about the openness to that, because to me that's the key to all this.
Sure.
Whether or not you accept it, whether or not this is an idea that's ever occurred to a listener out there, you're open to this idea, and it's precisely your openness.
I have an image I'd like to share with you.
Please do.
In the audience. I want people that are listening, I want them to think about what I'm saying now, to visualize what I'm about to say. And this is personal. It may offend some people, but it's from my heart. Many hundreds of years ago, envision this, thousands, hundreds and thousands and millions of black people, Africans, herded to the shores of Africa, being put on these ships to be sent to different parts of the world. The one missing thing, having studied history and having interviewed people all over, they never mentioned the state of mind of these Africans when they were being moved through these slave castles and boarded these ships. They never speak about the conditions of their minds or their souls when they're being transferred from one place to another. And I believe in the bottom of my heart that these people, from the time that they were captured, to this very day, that they were praying, that there were women praying for those babies, those unborn babies that were in their wombs. There were men praying for those sisters and those women of varying ages and varying tribes and various ethnicities. They all didn't look alike, but they were praying, and they were praying for the success and the longevity of those babies that were in those wombs. Those babies in those wombs carried with them. They're the sacred, it's part of the sacred deliverance system. And those babies now inhabit the whole world. Those prayers are what I want to get to. Those prayers were put into place by our ancestors, by our common ancestors, no matter what ethnic group or racial group we come from. Those prayers were in order when they left Britain in the Mayflower. They were on those ships when they left Spain and Portugal to go into the New World. All these people that embarked to move about, they had different takes. We're all victims of the times we live in.
So to what extent, again, we talked about this great sort of universal oneness in which we're all connected, and then our particular experience.
Sure.
To what extent do those prayers express the hopes and fears and aspirations of all of us, and to what extent, and how much are they particular to people of a particular
case? This gets into a little about the physics of music, the basics of music. It's about sound. It's about vibration. Allah. Whatever you want to say, however you want to say, it's a vibration. It takes place in time and space. It doesn't discriminate. It reverberates throughout the heavens, and they say it's still, according to Einstein, some of those sounds are still in place, moving through time and space. So it has permeated the universe. It has permeated everything we know. We are all victims of these vibrations. Some are more receptive than others.
So if you're going to use a tuning fork example along those lines, the stuff we're made of, when it resonates with us, that's our note.
This big note
has gone out. This big symphony has gone out with lots and lots and lots of vibrations.
Right.
The one that vibrated for us, the one that made us jiggle. That's it. Listen, respond.
Which is what
you've been doing most of your life. I want to come back to that. You were open to those sounds, and when that note made your tuning fork, you know, shake, you responded. You went off and did that thing. Your pilgrimage into Islam was much that way. Tell us about how you were introduced to Islam.
Well, actually, again, it was delivered to me. It was brought to my parents' door. My parents, this is amazing. During the late 1930s, several men jumped ship. I hope folks understand what jumping ship is. They were sailors that sailed into Boston Harbor, and they jumped. They left the ship. And they didn't know Boston at all. These men were from Somalia. They were from East Africa. They were Muslim. Somehow or another, two of these men met my father, and my father brought them home to eat at our house. One of these men, his name is Ali Musa. You know, may God bless him forever and send light to his tomb, wherever he is. This man, when I was a child, brought Islam into my parents' home. And that's when I first learned about it. I mean, as a child, not through lectures, not through books, but what I like to tell people through the Arabic word is adab. Adab means etiquette, manners. And as many people who come from foreign countries, particularly Middle Eastern countries, when they come to your house, they know there are children there. The first thing they ask is, where are the children? Where's the baby? So in this case, it's, where's the baby? You know, where's the little boy? And he would hold me and he would hug me. And he gave me that kind of love and words can't describe this situation. So as I grew, and as my father disappeared from our lives, you know, there was a lot of controversy in the house, and he had to take off to find a brighter place. And I bless my father for that, because what he did was he moved over. He shifted position for another man and many other men to fill in and be my father. And a father is not just the person who inseminates your mother. A father is a person who comes along and provides you with those things you need or what has been ordained for you to have, as you said about the tuning fork analogy. He vibrated and he brought it in. So he began to teach me about the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. He began to teach me about his culture. And he was, for those who are listening who happen to know Somali culture, he was from the Adam Madoba people, Adam Madoba. And it was in my mother's kitchen that he sang Dukayaga, which was the Somali liberation song. Because Mussolini had invaded the Horn of Africa at that time.
Yeah.
And many of the older men in the tribes had sent their sons out to travel the world to make money, to send money back to fortify the liberation movements in Somalia.
So we're listening to this story. We're hearing about a man who has had many fortuitous meetings, who is open to the possibilities, who learned intuitively and from the street, and also academically. At a certain point in your life, you realized that a kind of intellectual understanding of all this was important, and so you went to school. Tell us about that.
Well, I was I had dropped out of school. Some of my early influences in Boston were people like Rabindranath Tagore, who was the Indian national hero, Indian national artist, you know, educator. So, but he left school, too. That kind of inspired me. I got hold of some of his books at a young age. I left in the seventh grade, and I only had a seventh grade up until the time I was about 35. And then I met a few people who said, hey, man, you need to get it together. I was lucky enough to meet an elder who told me that I needed to embark on eliminating my complexes, my shortcomings, and to begin to do some self-analysis and embark on self-improvement. He says, the first thing you need to do is you need to go back and get rid of the most obvious hang-ups that you have in complexes. And that first one was, you have an educational complex. It's kind of hard. You can't hide those things. So even though I was well-versed in many things, I had to eliminate my problem. So I went back to, I thought I had to go back and sit in the seventh grade at 35 years old. I was that naive. And I actually went back and sat in a seventh grade class with the kids. And the teacher was amazed. And he said, hey, what are you doing here? You know, and the kids were, but they thought it was a joke, was a Halloween joke or something. And I said, no, I'm coming back to the seventh grade. I want to start here. And he said, no, mister, you don't have to do this. You know, there are other ways to do this. And I want to send you to a friend of mine. Here we go again.
Yeah.
There's an Irishman over there and, you know, watch out for him because he's smoking a pipe. He wears an old tweed jacket, and he has a cap on his head, and he smokes this pipe. But he'll help you through what they call the GED. This is 1967. So I went back and met the crazy Irishman and put up with his pipe tobacco, and he walked me through. And several months later, you know, when I returned from my pilgrimage to Mecca in 1967, lo and behold, what was in the mailbox but my GED? And then he told me, come bring it back to me. Both teachers said, come back to me. I want to see you. And they told me, now you are qualified to go to college. You know,
and you did.
Hop, skip, and a jump. And I went right into college.
Studying what?
And my first subject, they told me, they said, the key to success in academia is to choose a subject, look through glean the catalog, and find a subject that you have no knowledge of, that you don't know anything about. And I said, wow. He said, and you study that one, you take that one course and you master that course and you come out with either an A- or B+. And that will set you straight for your journey through academia. So I did. I followed. You know, they told me I had to learn how to follow instruction. And it was an Italian teacher that I went in his classroom in seventh grade. Okay. Between he, the Irishman, and the Italian, dig this. They got me straight. So I chose economics, and I get the syllabus, and I notice the text, the required reading, and I go to get Samuelson on economics. Anybody who studied economics, Samuelson's a great big telephone book size. I go to the bookstore, and they say $55. I said, no way can I afford this book. They said, well, you go to the library. And they may have a copy on reserve. So at this point, enters my wife. this is where she enters my life. So I go to the library, and I ask for Samuelson, and she begins to laugh. This young girl begins to laugh at me, said, man, you're really, you know, out to lunch. You know what I mean? People that want to take this class know you have to register in the library a couple of years beforehand. So anyway, I gave her a look and looked like I was going to pop her upside her head. She said, okay, come on with me. And she took me into the stacks and found a copy of Samuelson, and picked it up, blew the dust off it, and handed it to me. She says, hey, brother, liberation time. And the woman and the book had been with me for the last 41 years, you know, so... Again.
Only one of the stories of ethnomusicologist, musician, thinker, liver of a life, Dawood Haroun. We'll continue our conversation on the state of things just ahead. Please stay with us. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. That song is Mercedes, and it is from the album Ken McIntyre, The Complete United Artists Sessions. My guest, Dawood Haroun, is on the trombone, and we are spending an hour with him talking about his career and many, many lives in one. Tell us about that record, the recording session.
Wow. It sure does bring back a lot of memories. Mercedes, right?
Yeah.
Is that Mercedes?
Yeah, that's Mercedes.
Well, in many ways, it was a loaded title. Makonda, who... I miss it dearly. He was a great friend, a great mentor, a great human being. Mercedes was his sister's name. However, it also imitates in many ways the Mercedes, the vehicle, the smooth ride, because he always talked about, if you notice the names of some of his tunes, like Undulation, Mellifluous, it was this kind of smooth transitions. You know, how to concentrate a certain smoothness, musical viscosity, if you will. It's a happy tune. It's probably one of the happier ones. There were several that I had recommended that kind of encapsulated the tap dancers, the dancers in the street, musicians in Boston. That was the Stone Blues, which is really a tap dance rhythm.
Let's hear a little bit of that right now.
From the beginning.
I got Dawood Haroun doing air trombone here in the studio to that tune where he's playing with Makonda Ken McIntyre. That's your first recording together?
The first recording, yeah. We spent several years rehearsing his music to put that together. It was a great achievement for Boston. You know, that was really a wonderful situation.
That's a great tune. You talked about the kind of imitation of tap dance or the suggestion of tap dance, but also what's interesting in the beginning, you're basically mirroring him note for note. You're playing, you're playing the sort of the lower end of that on the trombone, but then you get to break out into that great solo. Huh? Was that improvisation?
Well, the melody, of course, was written. It was actually originally called Long John Blues. And the Long John that he wrote it for was a trumpet player that was in school with him at the Boston Conservatory. But it's an interesting construction. It's the blues, definitely. It's 12-bar blues, you know. But the interesting thing about this, as we rehearsed it, it morphed into something else. Because I have to mention, one of the musicians that was on that recording helped reshape it. And the musician who's on piano, he's listed as Dizzy Sal. His name was Edward Saldanha, and he was from Goa, India. He's perhaps one of the greatest jazz musicians ever to come out of India. As a matter of fact, he became quite a great man in India when he went back. But he was a young boy when he came to the United States, and then he came to Boston, and somehow Makonda found him and brought him into the band. Now, this is amazing. This kid had perfect pitch. Mm-hmm. He could hear and identify anything. And this is part of the wonderful part of this album, that Dizzy Sal brought in another dimension. Not only did he play the piano and accompany and play the proper harmonies and, as they say, comp, which is an abbreviation for complementing the music and the soloist, but he was able to hear where you were coming from in the tradition of the griot and the oral historian and the sympathetic Jungian type all-knowing ear.
Mm-hmm.
And when you played your solo, I mean, he could accompany the melody, but when you played, launched into your solo, he was there almost before you.
Mm.
And he provided an open arm, a platform to just open you up, because he was from a Vedanta type world of thought.
To break this down for a layperson who doesn't play jazz or even an instrument, you're playing along, you're planning to do a solo, you know how good you are, you know the limit of your talent.
I don't know about if you really know how good you are.
You have some sense of what you can do.
Taking a chance, you're leaping off the bridge, you're leaping off the into the abyss.
And there's something that he is doing in his support that is giving you, would it be greater confidence, a sense of
confidence, was a good word. Yeah.
Confidence that allows you to go beyond what you thought you were going to do with
Well, actually, song. Since you bring it, he could actually tune in to your heart. He could actually tune in to you spiritually, and he could anticipate. I mean, this is amazing. You know, you talked about how I was mirroring Makonda, almost no, I was like a shadow.
Yeah.
Well, there are shadows, and there are long shadows, and there are close shadows. He was part of that shimmering shadow that he surrounded those shadows in the shadows of all of the musicians in the band. It was at a quartet. We have, five people in the band. And this was really an imitation experimental composition, like a string quartet.
Mm-hmm.
And much of this sounds very medieval, and very medieval from the Indian subcontinent, medieval also, Carnatic music, if you will. And he was able to pull out of you and support you, and I hope this isn't too vague, he enmeshed with you spiritually and intellectually, and really complimented you on a level that you really took you out into that space to the one.
Whether I can identify with that or understand it completely or not, the fact is you did, and it meant something to you as a musician, and other musicians did.
Sure.
So you palpably, materially felt it, and it changed the way you play.
Sure.
And you thought about that, so not only
and
could
I
you feel
him
it.
A debt.
You not only did you feel it, but you thought about this and studied ethnomusicology.
Sure, sure. But ethnomusicology, bottom line, is really to study just about everything you can. Anthropology, archaeology. You know, it's about ethno, so it's about a particular ethnic group. In this case, for me, Africa and Africans, in all of their diversity. Not only the customs and the traditions, but the languages and the spiritualities, the multiplicity of spiritualities, to arrive at an understanding that all these different people who are here now, you know, come from this very diverse, this great diversity.
Right.
And they all come sensitized with different languages and different takes on how to cook rice, or how to cook chicken, or how to, you know, cook a yam, or cook whatever, how to dress, how to speak, how to move. You know, most people believe that all the people that were brought from one place are all the same. No, there's a great diversity of people. I mean, huge diversity of people. And to be able to find the commonality that runs through all of these people has sort of been my, has been my test.
The commonality while honoring the distinction at the same time.
Yes.
I think that's an important point that you've made before, is that it's not about diluting this into one sort of small world after all Disney tune. This is something much bigger than that, where you have all of that happening.
Yeah, that's where the great American dream and the melting pot can be really mistaken and misunderstood into thinking it's going to be, we're all going to mix up and become one big piece of fudge.
Mm-hmm.
And not even chocolate fudge, but like Panucci. Remember Panucci? Vanilla fudge.
God forbid we should become Panucci.
Panucci is.
But this for you, this is a fascinating thing because I think this is a, such an important, subtle, and nuanced point to make that we can maintain, we must maintain the distinction and also understand what pulls us together. And you're this kind of, you mentioned a griot. It seems to me that you're the sort of pivotal figure who is recognized universally. And I think maybe the best story that illustrates this is your Hajj, when you decided to make your sacred pilgrimage. Tell us that story.
Right. Well, it was meant to be. Again, there's no accidents, as my friends from the Rosebud Reservation. There are no accidents. Everything is decreed. And every step of the way before I got there and while I was there, it was meeting the world, because I was told by my teacher, when you go to, if you want to find yourself, go to the confluence where all the rivers of humanity meet. And I can't think of any place in the world where this happens but in Mecca. And people from all over the world, from China, from Russia, from Japan, from all through Africa. And like I said, I met people who walked there. It took them several years. I met children who were born on the way. You know, and they took the name Hajj because they did perform it. They performed it in their mother's stomachs. And it was a very profound experience. And as I said, I met many people, and they all didn't look the same way. They weren't all of one race, of one place. Many, many, many people came up to me speaking a language, and this is why I don't have a problem meeting and speaking with people, because people see you, they recognize you. And now I understand it's not the physical body that they're recognizing. They're recognizing, on one hand, a sort of a cultural or ethnic similarity. But in many instances, when it's really a really extreme, a very extreme situation, like a person from Denmark or a person from, you know, the Caucasus, you know, comes up to you and begins to say, hey, how long you been here? When you been here? And so that's when I say roots. I want to inform the public, the audience, is that roots is not singular. Don't think about roots as singular. Roots is very much plural.
What you're describing now, though, is an experience that some of us may have had. When you sit down, you see somebody who may not look like you for a variety of reasons. You sit down, you start talking, you realize you have a lot in common. I think we've all experienced that. But you had a unique experience, it seems to me, where a whole group of folks particularly recognized you from a part of their continent, and you'd never been there.
How about a part of their spirituality? How about a part of their heart?
But tell us how it happened. Describe. I want to hear that, but I want to know exactly kind of what was happening. You were walking. Did a bus stop?
Do you mean this first, the first big one?
Yeah.
I was walking through the desert. It's a place called Muna, where it's a layover spot. It's where the sacrifice of the lamb, the emulation of Abraham's sacrifice of his son. Mm-hmm. This is sort of an enemy of playing. This is Hajj is really a replay of Abraham's journey and trials and tribulations in the desert. So this is a replay. So I'm walking down the highway, a road, dusty road, and the buses are coming in back and forth, and there are people on the buses, like in India and Pakistan. You see people in Africa, buses loaded down.
Yeah.
All these people are waving at me, and I'm waving at them. And the buses are passing, the people are passing. I'm waving, and all of a sudden, one bus slows down, and a few men get off. They're all dressed in white, and they come over to me, and they started speaking to me. And of course, I didn't understand. And they thought I was joking with them. So a young man came by who spoke their language. Said, "Hey, you want me to translate?" And I said, "Yeah." He said, "Well, they're asking why. How did you get here before them?" And I'm saying, well, where are they from? And they said, well, there was somewhere like Cameroon or Togo, and they had walked across the continent of Africa to get this. So they had been on the road for a couple of years. And they wondered, how you got there before them? And I'm saying, well, I came from Boston. They were laughing. So the translator translated to them, well, he's from Boston. And they laughed. And they said, hey, you know, there's no Boston in Togo. There's no Boston in Cameroon. Until finally it hit them. Everybody, the translator was savvy enough to be able to explain, this is one of those guys that's part of those people that were taken away, those people that were. And they all began to be very solemn, and they said, oh, yeah, we were told about our brothers and sisters who had been taken away. And then they began to call, and the people began to flow off of this bus. This is a very profound experience. People began to flow off the bus over across the road to me, and women were coming with babies in their arms, and then they started putting these babies in my arms, and they were like kissing me and hugging me, and everybody started crying, and it was a very big emotional thing. And I was wondering, well, what's going on? They said, well, in the traditions in many of the tribes in Africa, they were also told, like my teacher told me in New York City, if you want to meet your family, you go to this confluence of all these places, and they'll find you. You don't have to look for them. They will find you. And, well, I guess that's self-explanatory, really. And it was a very moving thing. But for me, it happened several times while I was there, and it's been happening to me since the time I was born, and I imagine it'll happen to me until the day I die.
There is much, much more to tell. We are just about out of time. I think I've got 30 seconds left, so I need to congratulate you for winning the United Artists Fellowship.
Oh, wow. It's been a big, it's a mind blower, you know.
Pretty incredible stuff. I think we'll have to have you back.
I hope so. I'm at your disposal.
What a pleasure to meet you. My guest today, musician and artist and thinker, Daoud Haroun. We've got lots of photos from throughout your career at our website, stateofthings.org. You can see that and find out a lot more about him at our website, stateofthings.org. Our program is produced by Laura Lee, Anita Rao, Hadi Mawagdi, and Will Michaels. Alex Curley is our intern. Robin Copley, the technical director. Brent Wolf, WNC's news director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.